The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Antibiotic Prophylaxis for GI Endoscopy, the GI Perspective, is presented by Dr. Jack Bragg.
Thanks, Marty. Welcome to the GI section of the ACY presentation. Those of us that speak like this have two major fears. One is that we're going to be talking on a topic, and in the audience is somebody who's a world-class expert on the particular topic and don't like your interpretation of the studies that they did that you just quoted. Well, that doesn't happen very often. But the second fear is that you get up to speak and you notice that in the audience is one of your former trainers. And your mind flashes back to residency or fellowship when every presentation you gave was critiqued in detail. So who's the first person I see when I walk into the room today but one of my former trainers, Larry Wickless from Botsford Hospital in Michigan. And he didn't exactly put me at ease when he said, "I'll be taking notes." This is my disclaimer slide, and you have to point this somewhere.
Can we advance the slide? Take a hold of it. Once and then connect. Yeah. Oh, I got it. There you go.
So I have to do that every time.
No, I think it's connected.
Okay. So, when do we use antibiotics prior to endoscopy? I have two objectives today. One is to discuss when antibiotics for endoscopy are appropriate. The second objective is to discuss when antibiotics before endoscopy are not appropriate. There's one good source on this topic. There's a number of studies in the literature, but the source I got most of this from and the one that's the best and the most up-to-date is from the January issue of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy 2015. It's Guidelines for Antibiotic Prophylaxis for GI Endoscopy. Now, everybody knows that guidelines are guidelines. They're suggestions based on what evidence is available. Guidelines are not law. Guidelines are not etched in stone. And we have guidelines particularly for circumstances where the evidence is a bit iffy or is at the very least soft. I was talking with Bob Good before the lecture back there, and we were talking about how it was 25 years ago. This was a very straightforward issue. There wasn't much to it because everybody got antibiotics prior to endoscopy. If they had any history of joint replacement or any kind of cardiac type of mechanism in their body, everybody got antibiotics because nobody wanted to be responsible for a septic joint or a pacemaker that was infected. It was the mentality there wasn't evidence. The mentality was CYA. Nobody wanted to face a lawsuit for something that was very easily preventable. Well, there have been enough studies since that time that it has gone from very straightforward to complex, back to now where it's fairly straightforward again. At the other end of the spectrum, we almost, it seems like, never use antibiotics prior to GI endoscopy. But there are some specific procedures that I'll go over what these guidelines have to say, and I will discuss exactly what those procedures are that you do need to consider, at least, giving antibiotics prior to endoscopy. And there's two scenarios I can think of where it's always done that we'll talk about. Let me give you three very brief scenarios for you to think about as I talk, and we'll go over them again at the end. 69-year-old male with a prosthetic mechanical heart valve 10 years ago, you're asked to see for bright red blood per rectum and do an endoscopy. Does this individual need antibiotics prior? Number two, a 60-year-old female, cardiac transplant 2 years ago with valvulopathy, needs a surveillance colonoscopy for a history of polyps. Does she need antibiotics? Third scenario, 47-year-old male with a pacer defibrillator inserted or installed 1 year ago. Patient has cholecystitis, cholangitis, no obstruction, but stones in the common duct. Does that individual need antibiotics? Well, a little background here on what we're talking about. As you can see from the slide, in the year 2004, there were literally millions of endoscopies done in the United States. 14.2 million colonoscopies, 2.8 million flexible sigmoidoscopies, at many or more EGDs. And during the year of 2004, there were a combined total of 25 cases of infectious endocarditis, which there was a temporal association with an endoscopy. I didn't take time to do the math, but 25 cases out of probably around 20 million endoscopies is very small. So it's a very, very uncommon occurrence, and especially because the numbers on endoscopy are probably higher now than they were in 2004. The number of cases of infective endocarditis is probably elevated too, but again, it would have to be elevated a huge amount before it became significant. Advance. There we go. The American Heart Association has given us a list of conditions that have the highest amount of bacteremia associated with a procedure. Esophageal dilatation between 12 and 22%, that was from three prospective trials. Just as an aside, I do have a source or two quoted here that I thought was significant, but if you want to read the sources of all of these numbers and where they came from, that article from GIE in January of 2015 is the best place to go. Sclerotherapy, which we don't do much anymore, usually results in a bacteremia of about 14.6%. I think I've done one sclerotherapy in the last 15 years. Not done much at all anymore. Variceal ligation, which has replaced esophageal sclerotherapy, has a incidence of bacteremia about 8.8%. ERCP without obstruction of the common bile duct results in a incidence of bacteremia of about 6.3%. ERCP with obstruction of the common duct, about 18% incidence of bacteremia. An EGD and colonoscopy combined, all of these numbers have a mean of about 4.4%. So you can tell here we're looking at a significant but still a small number of people who get bacteremia after an endoscopic procedure of some sort. Well, compare that with these figures. Brushing or flossing your teeth will result in a between 20 and 68% incidence of bacteremia. I don't know anybody who's gotten infective endocarditis from flossing or brushing their teeth. It just doesn't happen. Use of a toothpick, 20 to 40% incidence, and simply chewing food results in a 7 to 51% incidence of bacteremia. So bacteremia in and of itself is common, and you can't use that as a surrogate marker for who's going to get a septic joint or who's going to get endocarditis or actually any kind of infective type of phenomenon. So what we're looking at here is a process, namely bacteremia, that occurs very frequently with and without endoscopy, but hardly ever results in a significant abnormality. In 2007, the American Heart Association published these guidelines. And they said, in part, prophylactic antibiotics solely to prevent infectious endocarditis was no longer recommended for patients undergoing GI endoscopy. And I don't think I included a slide to the effect, but the society that represents orthopedic surgeons has said basically the same thing, that to prevent a septic joint or an infected joint is no longer a good reason to give anybody antibiotics prior to endoscopy. And those are the two main reasons we used to give everybody antibiotics prior to endoscopy. But it turns out the average patient does not need antibiotics prior to endoscopy. Now there is a group of folks, and these are the ones that you need to recall, need to remember. A group of people that are at high risk for infectious endocarditis. Number one, prosthetic cardiac valves. Number two, a history of infective endocarditis. Number three, cardiac transplant patients with valvulopathy. Number four, congenital heart disease with unrepaired cyanotic defects and repaired CHD with prosthetic devices in the first 6 months. So what they're saying is these folks have a bit of an increased risk for infective endocarditis. However, the only time the American Heart Association recommends antibiotic prophylaxis, even in these folks, is if you have an active GI infection in which active enterococci is present. An active GI infection, and usually we're talking there about biliary cholangitis, biliary sepsis, that type of thing. That's where most enterococci comes from. That's a cause of sepsis or infection in the GI tract. So even these folks that are at a slightly higher risk that you see there, four different situations, if there's not an active enterococci infection, even they don't need routine antibiotic prophylaxis before a GI procedure. ERCP. What about ERCP? You've usually got stones. You're going to do a sphincterotomy oftentimes. You're going to manipulate the common bile duct with a balloon to extract the stones. You may have infection there. So what's the recommendation for ERCP? Well, here it is. ERCP without cholangitis or CBD, common bile duct obstruction, CBD, no antibiotics recommended. ERCP with cholangitis and or CBD obstruction, antibiotics are recommended in that scenario, and it should be an antibiotic that will cover enterococci. And we're talking here about this group of four people that I showed you the slide of earlier, the prosthetic heart valve and the CHD and all of those type of things. Very narrow indications. And it usually needs to be an enterococci infection. What about EUS? Well, EUS and fine needle aspiration has been around now for a while, but there isn't much in the literature that discusses infective processes following an EUS with an FNA. And you know how these guidelines are. They have various levels of evidence: strong, moderate, low, and very low is the way this set of guidelines is set up. The recommendations for EUS with FNA are in the very low category because there just isn't any evidence out there. Most of what's out there is case reports, studies with very small numbers, studies with people who gave antibiotics part of the time and didn't part of the time, and that there's nothing that a meta-analysis can really grab a hold of and come to any firm conclusions on. So these recommendations are soft. But what it looks like from the literature that is available is that in the case of an EUS with fine needle aspiration on a solid lesion, no prophylaxis is necessary. That's with a solid lesion, if you're doing a GIST or a pancreatic mass, whatever the case may be. EUS, fine needle aspiration for any cystic structure, whether it's a mediastinal cyst or a pancreatic cyst, antibiotics are suggested. And the reason for that is most likely the fluid in a cyst operates as a culture medium and it can become infected. Even with all the cysts, mediastinal and pancreatic cysts otherwise, that have been aspirated with fine needle aspiration in an EUS, there's still been very little infection result, but there has been enough that the guidelines recommend considering antibiotics if you are doing an EUS and FNA on a cystic structure, where the possibility of infecting the cyst is real. It's one of those, the previous speakers have alluded to this. I had a radiologist teacher when I was an intern and a resident who would give us a scenario and then he'd say, Jack, this is where you gotta be a doctor. Meaning this is where you have to use clinical judgment because there's no evidence one way or the other. And it's the same with doing EUS and FNA in cystic structures. Use your good osteopathic judgment as far as this individual gets antibiotics or doesn't get antibiotics. Next. Thank you. I mentioned two scenarios when we always give antibiotics. One is with PEG tubes, and what we fear there is skin organisms, even though we completely clean off the skin in the anterior abdominal wall before we put a needle through there, still you want to protect against skin organisms. So we usually what we do is give one dose, and this is the recommendation, one dose of antibiotics prior to, usually within an hour or so, of PEG tube placement, because there have been enough skin wounds, skin infections, abscesses, abdominal wall abscesses, post-PEG placement, that a dose of antibiotics, and most people use cefazolin, I think, but there's other things you can use. A dose of antibiotics prior to the EGD and the PEG placement is beneficial in preventing any kind of wound or skin infection. Some of you may be thinking, well, what about J-tube placements? Well, the same criteria apply. However, J-tube placements have not been looked at because they're not done nearly as often as PEG tubes. So there's zero evidence as far as what you do with placing a J-tube, but most experts would tell you that probably these are the guidelines that should be followed for J-tube placement, a dose of cefazolin or some antibiotic prior to placement of a J-tube, just as you would do prior to a PEG tube. The other situation, which, and this is one of those things that has just changed in the last 10, 12 years. Patients who are cirrhotic, with or without ascites, who come in with a GI bleed, whether it's a variceal bleed, peptic ulcer disease, that the house staff all has fear that when a patient with known cirrhosis comes in and they're vomiting blood, it's It's going to be a variceal bleed, and it's going to be a nightmare, and it's always at 2 a.m. But cirrhotic patients, even though they may have varices, bleed from something else about half the time. You see peptic ulcer disease, you see gastropathy from portal hypertension, you'll see a wide variety of things, bad esophagitis, so it's not a foregone conclusion that a cirrhotic that's vomiting blood has variceal hemorrhage, but it does occur a fair amount of the time. I don't know why this is true, but it's been demonstrated a couple of different times that antibiotics on a cirrhotic who has a GI bleed, regardless of the cause of the GI bleed, does prevent infection of almost any variety. And so it's become routine to give cirrhotics coming in with a GI bleed antibiotic treatment. And we usually keep them on it a few days until things settle down, the bleed is stopped, they're stable, there's no sign of infection, then we'll stop the antibiotics. I don't know that anybody has any idea why this works. I've never seen a study that demonstrated exactly why this is effective. Cirrhotic patients tend to be a little on the immunocompromised side. Everything seems to be out of balance. Nothing is normal from the immune system to the electrolytes. But for whatever reason, antibiotics in a cirrhotic seems to be a good idea. And so it's a recommendation on these guidelines that we do this every time. These are some iffy cases. Yeah, thank you. Neutropenia, an absolute neutrophil count of less than 500. If they're undergoing a GI procedure with a high risk for bacteremia, that would be, of course, ERCP with cholangitis. That could be esophageal dilatation. Would it involve colonoscopy with polypectomy? You'd have to decide that. There's no official recommendation. Time to be a doctor. Immunocompromised status with normal neutrophil count, again, a judgment call. If they are on their way up from no neutrophils to a good neutrophil count, and you're comfortable without giving antibiotics, that's the thing to do. But if you're not, and they've had infection before, you may want to cover them. There's no evidence one way or the other on somebody whose immunocompromised status has they have a normal neutrophil count. You have to decide that. What about peritoneal dialysis? This is another one of those things where the literature contains mainly case reports, anecdotal reports, studies with small numbers, numbers that don't have enough power behind them for us to come to any firm conclusions. And to the best of my knowledge, there was no meta-analysis yet on individuals with peritoneal dialysis. Do they need antibiotics? The feeling of the committee that put these guidelines together is prophylaxis may prevent peritonitis. That's a 100% maybe. Again, you have to use your own judgment. If it's a patient who has had repeated infections, whether it's peritonitis or something else, they're not strong as far as the immune system goes. You're on solid ground to give them antibiotics before an endoscopic procedure. If they're stable and doing well otherwise, you're also on solid ground not to give them antibiotic prophylaxis. When is it never recommended? Synthetic vascular grafts. And this assumes that there's nothing else going on, okay? This is a patient with a synthetic vascular graft that has a healthy graft. They don't have anything else going on as far as infection goes. They're coming in simply for a routine colonoscopy for polypectomy surveillance or screening, EGD for dilatation of a strip, whatever the case may be. The previous speakers talked about coronary artery disease stents. You don't need to give them antibiotics for a stent. pacemakers or defibrillators, an indication we used to give antibiotics all the time to, don't need it, again, under ordinary circumstances. Vena cava filters or peripheral vascular stents, not necessary. Orthopedic hardware, no evidence of benefit for prophylactic antibiotics in the patient with a total hip or a total joint of any type. Let me go back over those scenarios I started off with and see what you've decided. 69-year-old male with a prosthetic mechanical heart valve 10 years ago in the hospital with bright red blood per rectum, needs a colonoscopy. Would anybody give this guy antibiotics? No, good. 60-year-old female with a cardiac transplant 2 years ago with valvulopathy needs surveillance colonoscopy because of polyps. Does she need antibiotics? No, not if everything's normal otherwise. 47-year-old male with a pacer defibrillator 1 year ago, ERCP for cholangitis without obstruction. In other words, there's stones and there may be infection, but there's no obstruction. Does that individual need antibiotics? Answer is no. Pacemaker defibrillator a year ago, ERCP with cholangitis and no obstruction, no. You don't need, unless you're going to treat enterococci in the cholangitis. That requires antibiotics, but you don't need to protect the pacemaker defibrillator from infection in that scenario.